Right, we continue with this study, and I appreciate the good comments that many of you have made with regard to this kind of study. It is different for a Bible class like this. As I think I have stated to you before, it's a little uncomfortable for me to teach lessons like this in which we sometimes don't even open the Bible. And that's a little bit difficult for a Bible teacher. We like to get into the Word, of course, and look at passages. And over the years, I have not been said great kind things to those who don't do that. Like, we have a lot of people who just get up in the pulpit and tell jokes and tell stories about themselves and things of that nature, and have heard things of preachers going an entire lesson with giving one verse, and that's it. Of course, we don't want to do that. The Bible is, of course, the center of our faith so far as God's Word is concerned, and we should use it a lot and quote from it a lot. But this study is different. We're studying about the Bible itself. And so as a result, again, we don't open up the Bible a whole lot and go to book, chapter, and verse. And I appreciate your support and your kind words with regard to what we have covered so far with that. And I know that some of this material is and can be on the dry side because it has a lot to do with things that some people aren't all that interested in, to be honest with you. And excuse me, and I appreciate the fact that you have paid close attention and even have, again, been complimentary at what we have tried to do. So we have dealt with the Old Testament Bible in some detail. We know how the books were arranged and where they came from. Those with prophetic powers and those who were prophets, of course, were the writers of the Old Testament. So we talked about all of that and the importance of the Old Testament, that it is inspired by God, and that is so important. And in fact, we probably should study the Old Testament more. There's very few among us who are experts with the Old Testament. Like, there are some preachers who are. I could sit at the feet forever at those preachers. There's some preachers whose specialty is the Old Testament, it seems. And they do a great job in it. But most of us spend more time in the New Testament than the Old Testament. And we understand that as well. We know we're under the law of Christ, which is in the New Testament. And so we read all about the church and all of that, and the work that we do and how to worship in the New Testament. So we understand why we might put more emphasis on the new than the old. But certainly we understand that the Old Testament, to understand the New Testament to the fullest extent, you have to understand the Old Testament to some degree. And because of that, it is very important that you can fully trust the Old Testament. Like, now that we've talked about where the books came from and how they canonized the Old Testament and decided what books should be there and all of that, can we trust all these years later what has come down to us? And last week, if you weren't here, we went through, we won't go in as much detail, but just as review, we talked about the Masoretic text, and that is very important because that is the textual tradition that our Bibles are based upon. Like, unless you're a Catholic or maybe from the Orthodox Church, if of course all of the Protestant world, of course we don't consider ourselves Catholic nor Protestant, but if you have the King James, the New King James, the ESV, the Revised Standard, so on and so forth, the modern translations, the Old Testament. When it comes to the, we'll get to the New Testament, there's, of course, some differences between the King James and the ESV. Nothing major at all, not anything to make a big deal about it. Unless you're a King James only person, then we talk about that. But there are some, those versions are based upon some different sets of manuscripts that we'll talk about. But in the Old Testament, all of those versions that I just mentioned are based upon the Masoretic text. And so the Bible that you're reading from and that you study your Old Testament from is based upon that text. You remember, who do we say the Masoretes were? Who could tell me? Huh? All right, Jewish scribes, and they came around about the 6th century. And remember, we talked about the scribes, how they cared so much about making sure they were very accurate. And biblical scribes were even more so. And then the Nazarenes came along, and they went really to a fanatical degree. And so they counted all the words and all the letters that they wrote, and they even knew the letter in various books that they copied, what was in the very middle of the book, all of that. And we talked about how they added the vowel pointings there. If you see before, they remember the Jews didn't have vowels in their writings, and so they were just consonants. So you couldn't, really, when they read, it was by memory. They knew words by memory, which, you know, is natural, because so do you, right? I mean, isn't that the case with us? Most of the words you use and you know them because you've heard them. And from your parents growing up and friends and family and things of that nature. And really, if you think about it, most of your vocabulary started like that. And, of course, the more you read, then you increase your vocabulary. So people who read a whole lot might have bigger vocabularies, but most of the words you use, you learned by hearing them. And that's just, the way life works. And so the Hebrews operated like that. And they knew they could look at a word, and they knew it would be just consonants. And they knew that they know what it was, and they know how to pronounce it. Problem was, then Hellenization came along, and the dominant language everywhere began to be Greek, and the Hebrew language began to die out, except for, people right in Palestine and things. But of course you had the spreading of the Jews around the world, and the threat was there that everybody outside of the homeland would get to the point they couldn't even read their own Hebrew Bible. So the Masoretes came along, and you remember we said they had different goals. They wanted to, first of all, correct the errors that had crept into the Hebrew text, Hebrew Bible. Yeah, but they also wanted to come up with a standardized text that people could read for generations to come, and also make it so that it was such that it would guard itself against errors creeping in. They knew, no doubt, that you couldn't do that completely, but they tried to come up with a text that would guard against that. So they made all the corrections we saw in the marginal notes. They didn't tamper with the sacred text itself, but made marginal notes in between the columns and on top and on bottom. That's how they corrected the text. And then they added these vowel points and came up with that numbering system that would guard against error. And so they came up with the Masoretic text, and that's our text. So we talked about the Aleppo Codex, and that was the oldest Hebrew Bible text that we have record of. And so that was as far back. You see, 930 A.D. That's pretty late when you stop and think about it. There's no scriptural, manuscriptural evidence at all before that time that what we had is what they had back in the days that the Bible was being written. And so that's like over 1,000 years. Remember, that we're talking about copies of copies, because the original is gone. And so the latest we could go is 930 A.D. to find a text that supports our Old Testament that we use today. And so you had, that was the oldest one. It was damaged in a fire. Do you remember we kind of talked about that? The Leningrad Codex came in 1008, and that took the place of the Aleppo Codex when it was damaged in the destroyer. Anybody remember how it was damaged or why it was damaged? It kind of surfaces again even tonight. Anybody remember? Say it again, Taylor. Right, to the synagogue where it was. And because it remember in 1947, it broke out the newly body of people. The United Nations decided they were going to partition the Palestine into two states. And of course, the Arabs didn't like that at all, so they began to riot and that sort of thing in the synagogue where that wonderful codex, that was viewed in, among religious people as the greatest book on earth. And it had been stored for some 500 years or so in the Aleppo in Syria, and it was destroyed. But then we had this, and this codex was identical to the Aleppo codex, with a few differences, I believe, in some of the marginal notes and things. But the text was identical, and so that became the basis of what people would use, and copying the Bible. Then we talked about the rabbinic Bibles, and that one is only important because and what you see on the screen is actually a picture of what's called the Second Rabbinical Bible, which is the Old Testament that the 1611 King James Version used as its basis for the Old Testament. And so that becomes a pretty important text. And that's what they call a Masoretic text. And we talked about some other ones that were of importance, Biblia Hebraica and the Biblia Hebraica Stuttgartensia. And that last one, the Stuttgartensia, is in my Bible, the ESV. I went back and read that, and it used that very one as its textual basis. And I imagine you look at whatever translation you use, you could look up in your back and see it might give you some information about its textual basis and might be the same one. But that one, if you read that, it says identical to the Leningrad Codex, but with revised marginal notes. So, I mean, that all goes back. The Leningrad was identical to the Aleppo. So it's all the Masoretic text. See? And that's the traditional basis of our Old Testament. And so that's an importance of all of that. So, can we be sure then that the Masoretic text is reliable? Because it's a copy of a copy of a copy. And you remember, I mean, we've mentioned this kind of thing before, the old telephone game or whatever, you whisper a statement in someone's ear and then that person into someone else's ear, that person into someone else's ear, and you get to the end, does it sound the same? Usually not. Someone said in the game that they had the statement, if I remember right, they had the statement, I have a big black dog who likes to eat potatoes. And that's what was whispered in the ear of somebody. And then it went on to the next person, the next person, next person. The final person said the saying was, I went in the back and found a frog in my tomatoes. That kind of rhymes a little bit, but that's totally different than a big black dog that eats potatoes, right? And that gives tells us, you know, about this sort of thing, of what happens when information is passed from person to person, and you get a laugh out of that, and it's no big deal if you're just making that point, but not when you're talking about the Word of God. What if what they wrote, what Moses wrote in the Torah, and all the prophets wrote, what you read in the book of Psalms, what if what we have is as different as that little illustration there a moment ago? That's a big problem. That's a big problem. And there's not a few people, Bible critics, who say, yeah, that's exactly what happened. So you all, even if it were true that what was original was the Word of God, which they would probably even dispute that, but even if it were, you all don't have anything close to what was written all those years ago anyway. So can you be sure that you do? And the answer is yes. And the reason for that are various different sources that we have. So we closed off. We were talking about the Dead Sea Scrolls. And that really is the major reason. I mean, again, they were discovered in 1947. And what a discovery. I mean, it changed everything so far as at least man's thinking is concerned and our confidence that we could have in the written word. And you remember the story. I was relaying this in my mind. You know, the Arab boy who Muhammad was his name. He was with his cousin, and I had in my mind. We just barely closed that last week, but he was walking with his goats. Did I say sheep? Anybody remember that? Anybody take notes? Because I had in my mind, I told you all sheep, and I knew it was a goat. Maybe I said goat. You know those kind of things you can't remember. But anyway, he was walking with, he and his cousins, it was a goat. If I said sheep, correct that in your notes. It was a goat, and there's different versions of, you know, people tell the story a little bit differently, you know, minor details, whether he lost the goat or whatever. Some say lost it, some say saw it wander into the cave. But the point of it is that goat, he thought at least, went into a cave. So he threw a rock in there to get the goat to come out. And instead, he heard the shattering of pottery. So you go in there to check it out. And they went in there and they found all of these broken jars that the rock broke, or a broken jar. And then all of these jars that were in there with lids on them. And there were scrolls inside. And they found 7 scrolls. Now, do you think as they gather up those scrolls that they knew what they had? A Bedouin Arab just wandering around with his goat. He didn't have a clue what he had, in there. But he knew one thing. He looked old. And what usually can you say about old things? Right away he started thinking, I bet I can get a little something for this. So he gathered them all up. And left out of that cave with 7 scrolls. Well, over the next several months, he started to go to different dealers of antiquity and just let them know what, let them look at him, see what he had. And he came across one fella he became a broker. Khalil Shaheen was his name. And he became a broker over the years. What we find is that all of these scrolls that were found over a 9-year period of time. Like this is just cave one. And so there's going to be many caves discovered and many scrolls and manuscripts discovered. And this Khalil, he became kind of a broker. And he was a member of the Syrian Orthodox Church. So we're not surprised that in being the broker of these scrolls, that he arranged for Muhammad to sell 4 of the scrolls to the metropolitan bishop of the Syrian Orthodox Church, or the archbishop in Jerusalem. And so are you surprised by that? So, you know, he arranged a meeting for this little Ahab to sell to his bishop these scrolls. And so he did. And so this metropolitan bishop had 4 of the scrolls. The other 3 were sold to another fella by the name of Shalahin. And we don't know much about him at all, except for the family of the other fella, Cahil. They tried to suggest that that's not what happened, and that the other 3 scrolls were sold to somebody else that was more shady, but there's no real verification. Most people believe that they were sold to this Shalahin fella. And well, another guy, and I try to keep all these things straight, at least from the standpoint of pronunciation. I'm not a Jew. We're talking about Jews here. But this other fella, there was another fella who heard about these scrolls. His name was Eleazar Shunekik, I think it was his last name. It's strange. But he was an archaeologist. Now, what do you think an archaeologist would think about this? Just, you know, just rumor. Now, he's just hearing now that these things are floating out there. He doesn't know what they are, but someone has found some scrolls with some Hebrew writing on parchment that's very old. He's thinking, I gotta get a look at those things. So he arranges a meeting with this fella, Shalahin, who bought. But it's 1947. Now, what did we say just a while ago? What happened in 1947? The fire, but what caused it? Right. And so again, as I said earlier, that was great for the Jews. They're thinking they're getting part of their homeland back. But to the Arabs, that was disastrous. They rioted, and that's again when the Aleppo Codex was destroyed. But things in that region got very dangerous very fast. And this Eleazar, I can get that out there. He wanted them, so he arranged a meeting. Even though it was very dangerous, he went down there and he met with the fella, but not really. He could only meet with him for a couple of minutes and through a barbed wire, because he had to go to the place was already partitioned off, and so part of it was Arab and part of it was Jewish. So it was just the way it was. And so he could look at him through a barbed wire and just briefly. But he saw that it was a Hebrew text, and his expertise, it was very old. He figured at least back to the first century A.D. And, of course, we know it was even older than that. But he thought it went at least that far back. So now what do you think he's thinking? He wants those scrolls. I mean, there's no doubt in his mind now. He wants those scrolls. But again, he goes back home and things are very dangerous. But a couple of days later, he arranges another meeting. This time, he has to go by bus to Bethlehem, that's under the control of the Arabs. His son, who is in the defense of Israel, somehow connected, in the army, and he's telling his father, don't do it. I mean, you crazy. But he did. And he arranged a meeting and he purchased the scrolls. So he got them. And so now all of this happening, this is starting to spread abroad, because now the scrolls are on the open market and the people still don't know exactly what they are. But now the original fella, the metropolitan bishop, Athanasia, from the time he got his, he couldn't figure out exactly what they were, but he wanted to know. So he sent them to a fella by the name of John Trevor, and he was in Jerusalem. He was an American, obviously, and he was the founder of the archaeologist school in Jerusalem. And so he reached out to him and right away, John had been hearing about these things. So he had a meeting right away with Athanasia Samuel. And he took pictures of it, took his camera and took pictures of him and sent it back to a fellow by the name of William F. Albright, who was a famous American archaeologist. And he knew almost immediately, because that was his field. He specialized in that. He knew he could almost immediately decipher what exactly it was, so far as not just reading the Hebrew, but how old it was. And he realized rather quickly, this is a text of the Hebrew Bible going back at least to 100, not A.D., 100 B.C., And I can guarantee you, when he started putting all that together, he probably almost had a heart attack. Because, I mean, this is more significant than we could even realize. This, most people think that the Dead Sea Scrolls is the greatest archaeological find in the 20th century at that time. And, I mean, because you think about it. We now, all of a sudden, just like that, you go from having a Bible text that you're relying on that's 1,300 years removed from the original to having a document that goes all the way back to 100 B.C. Now you can start really having confidence in things. And so that was great, great news. And again, all of that started to be spread abroad, but now they kind of knew what they had. So you have in cave one then, that there in Qumran, this is what they found. They have Isaiah A and B. Now, Isaiah A, and that's a picture of it, and you can now go to Jerusalem into the Book of the Shrine Museum in Jerusalem, and you can see a facsimile of it. That's the entire book of Isaiah. Like most of the time in biblical things, and we'll get into this in the New Testament, when you start talking about the different pieces of evidence that we have, they're usually fragments. It might be a chapter, it might be a paragraph, but that's a manuscript. That's a manuscriptual evidence. This right here, Isaiah A, was the entire book of Isaiah they found in cave one. Then they also found another book of Isaiah, but it's just partial. And then a commentary on Habakkuk and a manual of discipline and the war scroll. A manual of discipline would be how whatever group of people you think are there, most people think it's the Essenes, I do too, but whoever it was that they, you know, they had a manual of discipline. And then there was a Genesis Apocryphon and 30 Thanksgiving hymns, and those were the seven scrolls that were discovered. Very, very valuable. Well, you know, now again, things are out there, and archaeologists and religious scholars and experts are thinking about, you know, wow, they found this in a cave. I wonder if there's any more caves out there. And so we can find even more of this value of these valuable documents. And even the Bedouin people who lived there, they were locals, and you know, they started thinking too, because now they really are thinking, money. But they had home field advantage, didn't they? They knew the area. So it became kind of a race and a battle between the archaeologists and the religious scholars and the local Bedouins who wanted to find some of these things too. And so we found that indeed in cave two, now this jumps forward to, I think 1952 or so, because all of this, you know, took some time, and they were not only finding this, but in the meantime they were excavating the Qumran, and that's when they found this little community that was there and everything, but in cave two they found fragments of all five books of the Pentateuch, as well as Jeremiah and Psalms, and then as well as other works such as Jubilees and the Book of Enoch. So some of the apocryphal books were the Essenes or whoever it was copied them as well, which is very interesting, isn't it, as you stop and think about that. But that's what was found in cave two. In cave three was really interesting. They only found about 12 fragments, some biblical, some not. But they found what you see up there is a copper scroll. So they did some writing on copper, and it had information about buried treasure on it. So there was supposed to be treasure all over in Jerusalem and other places from the temple, silver and gold, and on that copper scroll, it had information where you could find some of that treasure, where to look. But now nobody's ever found any. So. But that was in cave three. Now, cave four was interesting only because it was a cave. It's called the Partridge Cave, because the story goes there was a group of these Bedouins who are now sitting around, and they're excited because they're going, you know, these all of a sudden their area where they live, it's filled with archaeologists and religious experts, and they're looking for these manuscripts, and they're trying to find them themselves. And so a group of them was sitting around a campfire, and they're just talking about it with excitement. And, you know, how can we beat them to it? And one of the older men said to the younger ones, you know, going back, he said, about 20 years ago or more, he was hunting a partridge and winged it. And the partridge went into a cave. It's almost like the goat story, but it's true. Went into a cave, and he went in there, and he saw some jars and everything, He didn't think anything of it at all, because no discoveries had been made or anything. Nothing. He just, for whatever reason, he just wasn't very inquisitive. Whatever, he just left. And now they're sitting around this campfire, and he's remembering this time when he saw these jars in the cave. And the young men asked him, said, "You think you remember where the caves are?" He said, "Yeah, I think I do." And they went to the cave, and they discovered cave 4. And cave 4 had more information in it, more manuscripts than any of the other caves. Maybe more than all of them together. And they found 15,000 fragments from more than 200 works in cave 4, including what you see there, which is you could see by the heading there, 4Q Samuel. That's from the book of Samuel. And by the way, that's how they now separate all the things. Remember in that first one with Isaiah? Do you remember it had 1Q ISA, which would mean one, it would be cave 1. And the Q, of course, is Qumran. And then it would have the initials of whatever book it was. And then in this, it says B, so we know that there were at least two manuscripts of Samuel that they found, maybe more. In Isaiah, there was two, but that's what that means. So you look at that, and you know that's from Samuel. And it's the old, it's from, you see there, from the 3rd century. And I'll have to double check, but if you're making notes, correct that. I think it's from the 4th century. Somehow I think I got that wrong. But I'll double check. But anyway, that goes way back. That's the oldest, that piece of Samuel is the oldest manuscript that we have that has biblical writing on it, that Hebrew biblical writing on it, all the way at least the 3rd century B.C. And so that's what they found in K4. Then in K5 and 6, you had in 5, you had some biblical books, some apocryphal books as well. Now, cave 6 is interesting. In cave 6, everything that was in there was papyrus. All these things that have been discovered so far have been parchment, have been leather. And for whatever reason, in cave 6, it was all papyrus instead of leather. And then cave 7 through 10, you know, they found some things that were interesting to the archaeologist, but unless you're an archaeologist, nothing of interest, particularly to us in this study. And then in cave 11, they found the complete book of Psalms, as well as portion of Leviticus and Aramaic Targum. Just that is their translation of the Old Testament into Aramaic. In this case, a paraphrase of Job. And then a temple scroll that was about 28 feet long. So those in 11 caves then, those were the caves that were found where all the Dead Sea Scrolls came from. Now, what a wonderful discovery. These things go, again, way back B.C. I mean, that is huge in proving the text. Now, how does it prove the text? Here, first of all, at Lightfoot says, according to a recent count, the book of Psalms is represented in all these Dead Sea Scrolls, is represented 36 times, followed by Deuteronomy 29, Isaiah 21. Again, there was two in cave 1, but all together, when you put them all together, 21, Exodus 17, Genesis 15, and so on. So that's the kind of the way that it worked. Now, most of these things are just fragments, but some of them are entire books. Well, in cave 1 and cave 11, you had entire books. The rest, just fragments. But there you have it. Now, here, watch the significance of this. Here, one of the things they discovered as they began to make these discoveries and read them and compare them, that first one, you can tell by the heading there, 1QISA, what is that? That's Isaiah. That's the complete book of Isaiah. And when they began to compare that with the Aleppo Codex, it was identical. Identical. Now, let me tell you, that ought to give you chills when you think about that. Because we were relying on the Aleppo Codex and thinking, you know, that's, Boy, that's 1,300 years removed. And then all of those years later, they come across a find of a manuscript that was in 100 B.C. and held it up to the Aleppo Codex, a part that they had left, and identical. Those scribes got the job done, didn't they? They were paying attention. But it's identical. And that's what our Bible is based upon. And that's why it can give you confidence. We know for a lot of different reasons that those scribes, they followed as they should precisely. They copied very carefully. And we can be sure that we have it. I mean, you add to all of that, of course, the providence of God, and he's not going to let his word be destroyed, and that's probably the most powerful thing. But when you start comparing these manuscripts that are found, it's just amazing. And Norman Geiser says, altogether, of the thousands of manuscript fragments constituted the remains of some 600 manuscripts, about 60% were proto-Masoretic. What that means is that the majority of those texts then were on the basis of the very same textual tradition from which we get our Bible today. All the manuscripts that they found weren't based on the same tradition. 5% were pre-Samaritan, 5% the Hebrew text, which underlines the Septuagint, which was just a little bit different. But even there, the differences, the variations were so little, they're not hardly worth even talking about. Now, some of them, when you start talking about the difference between the Septuagint and the Hebrew text, there's a few places that are significant. And we'll talk about that later. But most of them are very minor thing. But most of the Dead Sea Scrolls represented the Masoretic text, which your Old Testament is based upon. And that's why, quickly, I know we have to go here, but Joshua McDowell, the Dead Sea Scrolls demonstrate unequivocally the fact that the Jews were faithful in their transcription of biblical manuscripts. There is very little doubt when you begin to compare these ancient manuscripts and how they line up that what we have, very, very much the same. Are there some variants? Yes. And most of them have to do with misspelled words and that sort of thing. But they're almost identical. We can be sure that we have the Word of God. And a lot of that comes because of that great discovery. And it didn't change anything, but in our minds it now gives us confidence that we have exactly what was written in those original writings that are long since been destroyed or lost. So we'll pick up there next week. Appreciate your attention.